Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, following complaints over how the school handled a series of sexual assault allegations, Myers Park High School's principal is reassigned. Get ready for a months-long discussion over the Unified Development Ordinance, the UDO. City Council got its first look, and it is both comprehensive and complicated. It follows the 2040 plan, and the city has just released their first place types map. We take a look. The county releases an analysis of housing and homelessness, and though COVID trends are heading in the right direction, new data shows vaccination rates among healthcare workers in nursing homes is low. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's healthcare reporter Claire Donnelly. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
You're Irish. I should say top of the morning. Jonathan
yes,
Lowe.
Please.
I will. Jonathan Lowe is an anchor reporter for Spectrum News One. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta Soloff is with us. She reports for Axios Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is back. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric, welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
We're going to begin with the Myers Park principal reassignment. And for that story, we're going to bring in WFAE's Sarah D'Elia, our crime and justice reporter. So let's back up a little bit here, Sarah. And good morning, by the way.
Good morning.
These allegations of sexual assault and rape go back several years, and they went largely unnoticed, I think, until WBTV started doing some digging back in 2015. It's been a while. Give us some background on how we got to where we are today.
Sure, yeah, and WBTV has done a really great job of interviewing survivors and women that have come forward with their stories, for sure. I think to boil it down to the biggest case that sort of pushed this into the forefront of everyone's minds is a lawsuit that was brought forth by a woman that went by Jill Rowe, but she's done many interviews, including with me, WBTV, and others, and her name is Nikki Womwell, and she had a lawsuit with CMS and against embattled former principal now at Myers Park, Mark Bosco, saying that she was assaulted in 2014 on the campus of Myers Park, and that when she went to report her assault, she had to report it several times. And when it was when she finally was able to have a conversation with then principal Mark Bosco, was felt like she was dismissed, was told that, you know, pursuing charges against this young man that she said assaulted her could have negative impacts for her, and that if he was found innocent, that there, you know, there'd be consequences for her as well. And so this lawsuit has kind of been at the forefront of this. It was recently settled in 2021 in April, and she chose to be able to speak. She didn't sign anything that said that she couldn't share her story. So she really has been a big voice in what's been going on at Myers Park.
And this was not an isolated incident. There have been several incidents of this, and with similar stories of how their reports of sexual assault allegations were handled. And you spoke in the course of reporting on this yourself to several Myers Park students. They told you what they wanted to happen to the principal, Mark Bosco.
I would like Mark Bosco to resign.
I don't think Mark Bosco should be allowed to work around children again.
Well, Bosco needs to be fired because his handling of the situation is ridiculous.
Bosco should be fired.
But that is not what happened, largely due to WBTV and other media outlets pressing the issue and not getting satisfactory answers from CMS on what was going on. The system first suspended that Myers Park principal in August as they investigated, and now they have reassigned him. In a message to parents, CMS wrote, quote, both Mark Bosco and Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools believe that after 8-plus years as a principal at Myers Park, change in leadership is needed at the school. Opaque. No? What else has the system had to say about this reassignment, and what are we to take from it, Sarah?
Well, we, of course, reached out to CMS and asked them, what does an investigation look like? What other details can you share with us? And that statement was pretty much all that we've gotten. I've reached out to some board members and to some people that are connected to this, and really there hasn't been a ton of response. I mean, over the summer when there was a school board meeting, I think one of the most fervent voices you heard was from school board member Rhonda Cheek, who said that, you know, if she had it her way, she would get a bulldozer and bulldoze down the wooded area where these alleged assaults are happening. But CMS has been largely quiet about this. I did get a statement from Nikki Womwell, the woman that had the lawsuit against CMS and Mark Bosco. And in it, she, you know, was happy that he is not going to be returning as a principal, but said that she was not contacted as part of the investigation. And she also says that survivors that she knows were not contacted as part of the investigation. So I think there's still a lot of questions from students past and current who want to know what went into this investigation and what exactly was found.
She told that to WBTV too, or somebody did, so that they nobody was contacted as in the course of this investigation. You've been able to confirm that?
Yes, she sent that statement to me as well.
But I mean, we've been able to confirm that that is in fact the truth.
Oh well, we have asked CMS what went into the investigation, and they have not responded.
Okay. Mark Bosco has responded. His attorney released this statement. After a lengthy and thorough investigation of the facts, CMS finds no basis to conclude that Mark Bosco mishandled or failed to respond to any allegation of sexual misconduct. That attorney, Sally Higgins, went on to say that coverage of this by the media has not been fair to Mark, and that he could not comment on specific allegations because of obligations of confidentiality. But, quote, he can say that to his knowledge, any situation at Myers Park involving an accusation or evidence of criminal conduct was immediately reported to CMPD. If that's true, does that put the onus of this on CMPD? Clearly, they didn't act.
I think there are a lot of questions around how school resource officers responded, especially to Nikki Womwell's case and other survivors that have come forward saying that they felt like there have been instances where school resource officers should have seen suspicious activity going on, should have seen students going into a wooded area at a time of day where they shouldn't be. And then there have been women who have said that, you know, I tried to report this to a school resource officer and I felt like it wasn't taken seriously. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. I think there's a lot more to look into as the policies, the procedures that are going into reporting these assaults that are happening at CMS, not just at Myers Park, but across CMS. We've also had issues most recently at Olympic High School as well. So this is definitely not isolated to Myers Park.
Jonathan.
I was just going to add there, because I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but Mark Bosco was reassigned to a position within central office where he's making the same salary as he was making as principal of Myers Park High School. He is going to be the senior administrator of expanded learning and partnerships. And what I think is interesting here, CMS did put out a kind of a job description of what he's going to be doing. And just kind of paraphrase, he's going to be ensuring the equitable and expanded access for students to engage in extended day coaching in core academic areas. So you wonder, as Sarah was just mentioning there, it's been hard to get any sort of clarification on anything that's gone on with the investigation, who they've talked to, and also what was going into, you know, what went into the decision to reassign Mark Bosco. Now he's over a position that, you know, what he will be doing certainly does impact students and is related to student equitable learning. Kind of an interesting next chapter for him, considering what he's gone through with these allegations at Myers Park.
Is this also it's a newly created position? Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
That was my question. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say from all accounts, it's a newly created position. So I think that's going to raise eyebrows as well. You know, when did they decide to create this position? How did he become the front runner? Were other people interviewed? I don't know the answers to these questions, but they seem like relevant questions.
I want to go back to this wooded area, because in July, Sarah D'Elia, you filed a story about this, because this has been going on for months. And you spoke to young women, one of the young women who reported being assaulted in 2013, and she told you that her assault occurred in that wooded area. You've already mentioned this. In 2013, near the high school, and the principal told an assembly of students, I think in 2014, that the school was not responsible for what happened in the woods. He's quoted as saying, "Some people go into the woods and don't come back happy. But those woods are on school property, are they not?
Right. The majority of those woods through the story that we did, because there was a lot of questions about who owns this. It's kind of these wooded areas are sort of like this hot potato that everyone keeps tossing to each other. But the majority of it is CMS property. And
so wouldn't they be responsible? Yeah, well, they would be responsible for that, right?
That's what a lot of victims and their attorneys say. And that assembly, I should say, Mike, is really an important part of this. Mm-hmm. It happened towards the end of 2014 or the beginning of 2015. It was after Nikki Womwell's assault. And that I've talked to a lot of students who remember that assembly, who remember that woman that you mentioned, Joy Poe, that's not her real name, a pseudonym. She says she was like, I remember being in that assembly and being told, you know, that this was basically my fault. And I believed that for a really long time, that because I allowed myself to be taken into these woods, that I shouldn't report it because it's my fault. I mean, you're talking to 13, 14, 15 year olds, you're talking to minors here, and words really matter, I think, in the way that we talk to kids about this kind of stuff.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, Mike, if you talk to any former student that went to Myers Park, they will tell you that going to the woods that surround Myers Park's campus, at least when I was there, you know, we had SROs who made sure to let students know that that's not where you should be. So it's interesting to hear this difference in opinion based on the administration, but it's always my understanding that you were not allowed during school hours to be in the woods that surround the campus.
So there was this period of time this past summer where CMS did not seem to be able to clearly articulate the policy surrounding sexual assault or allegations of sexual assault, or at least could not satisfactorily explain why it took so long for them to respond to these allegations in a satisfactory way. Has that changed in any way? Have they now clearly articulated what that policy is?
I would say from the students that I've spoken to most recently is that it's still very much a work in progress. And CMS, to their credit, has had Title IX task force presentations during board meetings. There was one at the summer. It did come extremely late in the meeting. I don't know how many people were still awake at that point to see it, but it looks like they are trying to simplify the process, trying to make it as easy as possible for people. There's now, there should be on every school website, a very clearly marked kind of link you can click on to go right to Title IX questions and about the process of exercising your Title IX rights. Ernest Winston, the superintendent of CMS, has formed a Title IX task force that does have current students on it, and they are looking at policies and practices and are supposed to be sharing some of those best practices and possible changes in November.
Have things changed since 2014? In other words, were these policies or something like them in place between 2014 and 2019 or 2013 when these allegations began to crop up?
I mean, Title IX has definitely, you know, that was something that was around there for sure. But I think that students that were there would say that they didn't understand their Title IX rights. And hopefully now that conversation is changing and it's a more transparent policy. But I think it is still very much a work in progress.
Sarah D'Elia is WFAE's justice and crime reporter. Thank you for filling us in on all the details of that. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. When we come back, we'll talk about the Unified Development Ordinance, our first conversation, I think, of any substance about what will be an ongoing topic as we go through the next several months. And we'll get an update on the COVID situation and pay raises for school bus drivers, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7, WFAE and 90.3, WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, along with Katie Peralta Soloff from Axios Charlotte, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, and our own Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter here at WFAE. Let's go on to something that we'll be talking about for months to come. This will become the new HB2, the Unified Development Ordinance. This is Charlotte's first comprehensive revamp of a hodgepodge of zoning ordinances that have come about over the last 30 years. The Charlotte 2040 Comprehensive Plan, which narrowly passed earlier this year on a 6-5 vote, will serve as a guideline for how the city will grow, and the Unified Development Ordinance will provide the regulations to put those aspirations into practice. Did I adequately describe what we're talking about?
You did, Mike. It's okay. It's so straightforward and simple. I don't think anybody yes. will get lost along the way.
So are we to assume that since the Comprehensive 2040 Plan was so difficult to get through city council and caused behavior unlike anything we've seen before on council, that this discussions on this will be even worse?
Oh, it's going to be smooth, Mike. I mean, let's start with the fact that we have the first of four drafts, and it's a mere 608 pages. I mean, that is shorter than War and Peace.
This is advertised as being user-friendly.
User-friendly, streamlined language, more consistent. What could possibly go wrong? We have 608 pages, and we're going to tinker with them unmercifully for the next, almost another year. This will finally wrap up in July 2022. But you described it very well, Mike. I mean, the whole idea is to have a modernized and contextualized document that makes it easier for people to develop.
Well, you know, we make jokes, but I feel like, and I don't know if Eric will agree, but sometimes you can tell when things are very complex, and maybe some on the council, I'm just guessing, are stumped as well and are just as confused as we are. Because that conversation earlier this week, you know, them going delving deep into this comp plan and the UDO, which I know you're going to get into, but it was the most polite, civil. It was unlike anything we saw with the discussions earlier this year dealing with the comp plan. And I come away from it thinking, are they as confused as I am about these 608 pages? Because that went pretty smoothly.
Here's the other thing. Remember, we first saw the 2040 plan, I believe it was Halloween of last year. And then they sought feedback from the community for months after that. But it was pretty quiet following the initial release of this initial document that was like 320 pages. This is, in my opinion, much more nuanced, complicated. There's a lot to it. There's a lot of jargon in there. So eliciting the appropriate amount of community feedback is going to be a real challenge if they want to meet these deadlines in order to kind of move this thing past these benchmarks that they want to move them past by next summer. So it's going to be very busy over the next several months.
Well, we have 9 months to talk about this, and so we're not going to get into all the nitty-gritty details of this one, but in this conversation. But this was the first draft of what city planners hope will be this user-friendly document. And one thing it proposes is the creation of new zoning districts. What does that mean, and what do we know about those new zoning districts?
So you're talking about basically parts of town. Currently, you know, you have the zoning district for industrial parts of town or residential parts of town or the central business district. And those are all, now I'm not a zoning expert down to the, you know, knowing those different codes, but basically city council in this first draft, you know, Taiwo Jayoba, the city's planning director, went through and his staff went through how they're going to reclassify multifamily housing that will include duplexes, triplexes, single family homes. And I believe, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, but that will be MF. That's gonna change to multifamily in some way, MF A, B, and C. Then again, you'll have new zoning districts for industrial parts of town, as I mentioned, where you have schools, that sort of thing. It's a very long list.
And they're introducing a new vocabulary, place types. Place types sound very similar to what normal zoning would have done. There are commercial zoning areas. There are industrial zoned areas. There are residential areas. They have now become place types, if I understand this correctly. And within the neighborhood place types, there are six zoning districts labeled N1A through N1F. That's user-friendly. It sounds complicated, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Katie said is correct. I mean, this is very nuanced. It is complicated. And for all of my mockery of the 608 pages, I mean, it takes a lot to explain these things, because we're talking about everything from trees and subdivisions to floodplains and stormwater. And you are talking about taking policies that were created over 30 years separately and trying to put them together, all while the city is growing at a headlong pace. So, there's a lot to unpack here.
So let's just take one, because we'll have months to talk about this. They've classified areas, as I said, as neighborhoods, N1 through N1A through N1F. Neighborhood 1 or Neighborhood 2, parks, commercial, educational, campus, those are some of the other ones and so on. But let's go to Neighborhood 1. Those include areas like Myers Park, Freedom Park, Chantilly, and the parts of Dilworth away from South Boulevard. Let's just call it that. Those are considered low-density housing neighborhoods, and can have single-family or small multifamily homes, or ADUs. So what's an ADU? Is that new? And is this the piece that allows duplexes and triplexes in traditionally single-family neighborhoods? Is this the change? I've stumped the panel.
I have to admit, I have not read anywhere close to all 608 pages.
All right. Well, there's an animated map, or an interactive map, that the city has put up that you can go to check out your own neighborhood. They've color-coded all the neighborhoods with descriptors in them, and you can find that somewhere on the interwebs. This is an ongoing process, and I guess July is when they have to vote on this. Is that right?
That's right. One other thing I would mention, Mike, that's going to be interesting is, you know, the bonuses that are involved for development, you know, in terms of denser development. If you include affordable housing, that's already been around, but they're adding things like LEED certification, street connections and things like that. So I think that'll be an interesting part of our 9-month-long conversation.
Okay. Well, heads up, it's coming. It's here. Mecklenburg County just released its State of Housing Instability and Homelessness Report. What does it reveal, Eric?
It reveals, I mean, some things that would I think be obvious to people, such as that the pandemic has worsened a lot of the housing situation, but it puts numbers behind that, and it shows that we are, for example, we have 28,000 households in Mecklenburg County that are behind on rent or at risk of eviction, with average debt of $3,600. There are a lot of details like those. And the other thing is that we continue to plummet in terms of affordable housing. That was the statistic that jumped out at me, that in 2011, 45% of the rental supply was considered low cost, that is under $800 a month. By 2019, it was down to 22%. So that is why we have these conversations week after week, Mike, about affordable housing.
And rents are rising rapidly in the wake of the pandemic. I want to go back to that number of people behind on their rent. I think you said it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 28,000 or more people behind on their rent by about $3,600 on average. The eviction prohibitions have ended. Does that mean we should anticipate more homelessness quickly in the future?
Well, you know, you would think so. That's been a lot of the worry. I know that the national figures have said that we have not had the wave of evictions that was anticipated. One of the statistics that's in this local report is that the number of evictions went down, but of course did not go away. So I think that's something that we have to keep an eye on. And as you said, Mike, referring to that, both the people that are at risk and the low-cost rental supply, over and over again in this report, using statistics, it reveals that low-income earners, Black households, Hispanic households are being hit the hardest, both in terms of job losses and rising rents. So that is why we have these conversations again and again, and people are trying to figure this out.
And I guess one of the things that stuck out to you, they intended for it to stick out, because the county reports that the single biggest takeaway is the continued need for more permanent, affordable housing. And they go on to say that that's why it is, quote, critical that all stakeholders use the information in the report to ask for more permanent, affordable housing in the county, especially for those households who have the lowest incomes. Two questions. Who are the stakeholders and who do they ask?
Well, I think, you know, the stakeholders, if you look at the report, you have the usual people involved in these issues, people like Roof Above, Salvation Army, the county, the city, the hospitals, all those groups. And I would say at minimum, the question is being asked. I mean, if you look at what city council in particular has been talking about in terms of affordable housing, if you look at the private matching funds from the Foundation for the Carolinas, if you look at some of the purchases of old apartment complexes to keep them from being demolished, there are certainly efforts in this area. The problem is there's nowhere near enough money, and it is so hard to preserve that affordable housing. So that is really the crux of the problem, and this report really lays it out clearly.
So now we know it. The report's out there. What's going to happen as a result of the report being out there?
Well, I think that what this does is probably keep the spotlight on it. And one of the things that I think was in the report, or certainly in response to the report, is that right now is an especially good time because the pandemic has highlighted the vulnerabilities, and there is a lot of federal relief money out there that can be further steered into some of these recovery programs and into preserving affordable housing. Remember, the city and the county still have, I don't know, $100 million or more coming in from the American Rescue Plan. So some of that money will go to those efforts.
If you're listening,
the other thing that, sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say that one thing that also stood out to me is there's of course, and you know, as necessary, a lot of attention on the lowest income earners in Charlotte who are severely cost burdened. But there are also folks like firefighters and janitors whose salaries simply do not allow them to afford the average one bedroom apartment in Charlotte. If these people would have to either work more hours or pick up a different job in order to afford the average rent. So I think it also casts light on
what does it take to be the nation's number one cancer center?
Needing the need for increased wages. And that is certainly happening across the board in Charlotte. And you know, the affordable housing piece is obviously a crucial one to address, but the other significant part of it is well-paying jobs in order to actually be able to afford some of these places that are just considered average.
And Katie, that's an important point, because I remember when the Foundation for the Carolinas was putting together the private fundraising for this affordable housing effort, one of the things that they did was they would illustrate, they would have a firefighter or a teacher trying to put a face to housing problems that it would surprise some people how many ranges of people and occupations are affected by this problem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, it is now if you're listening on Friday morning, it's now 9:35, 10, 11, 12. And we have not talked about COVID yet, but we are about to embark on that. For the second week in a row, it's been pushed deeper into this news roundup because the trend lines are headed in the right direction, at least in most parts of the country. Dr. David Priest is an infectious disease specialist with Novant Health, and he says that after a major spike because of the Delta variant, cases are headed down.
I think we're on the downswing of the fourth wave. I think that we can say that with a lot of confidence. If you look at national models, is that we'll have a continued downward trend with this into the spring.
North Carolina reported its lowest daily increase in COVID cases in over 2 months this week. So where do we stand, and why are we making headway, Claire?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that in that clip, he calls it the fourth wave. There's been a lot of debate over what wave of the virus we're in. I don't know. I'm impressed that he's been able to keep track. I guess he does work for Novant, so... But what is going on? There's a lot of factors. So first, we know, you know, more people are getting vaccinated. Second, we know the Delta variant really ripped through the population. So now, you know, a lot of people who were infected have some natural immunity. The question is, how long is that going to last? So if you did get COVID, if you did have the Delta variant, you should still get vaccinated because vaccine immunity is better than natural immunity. But that definitely points to why we're seeing the numbers trend downward.
And we're learning different things, or we're being told different things about the efficacy and the long-lasting nature of the three vaccines that are available to us, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. And the FDA is still making decisions on when and if you should get a booster shot if you got the Johnson & Johnson or the Moderna vaccine. Pfizer, if you got that, they're telling you to go back and get the booster shot if you've had the two other shots for Pfizer. But there's some question about whether Moderna might be the longest lasting of the three, and we don't know. And they're still deciding about whether it would be good to mix and match these. If you got the Pfizer, maybe you should go back and get the Moderna booster shot and vice versa. And they say that, I heard yesterday that one medical expert is saying, yeah, it shocks the body and it creates a different set and a stronger set of antibodies. This is all very confusing for the average person, and particularly for people who are suspicious of this in the first place. Is there any way around this? Because we're finding these things out. We're watching the soup being made.
Is there any way around it? I don't know the answer to that. I think there could have been more clear throughout the whole pandemic. There could have been more clear messaging from federal health officials, from local health officials about what to do when, because you're right. What ends up happening is, you know, the Pfizer booster gets federal approval, and then people who didn't get Pfizer for their initial two shots feel sort of left in the lurch, confused. What do I do if I got Moderna? What do I do if I got J&J? And to your point, I think there's a federal committee meeting today on the J&J booster decision. We'll hear what comes out of that. No, it's not clear. It's probably unlikely that they're going to recommend mixing and matching. I'm not sure that's necessarily the right call, but yeah, I mean, it's confusing.
Jonathan?
And I was just going to say that, you know, to add to that point of it being confusing, take for instance the Johnson & Johnson shot. I believe they, after the first shot, you are around 50% effectiveness. And I think it jumps to, like, I heard yesterday, 75, 76% efficacy. But if you get it within 4 months after your first shot. So yes, I think that's been the case with this entire pandemic. Everything from masks to vaccines to social distancing to all of it's just, you hear so many different things. And yes, it does make it harder for those who are hesitant about getting the vaccine to know what's accurate, what's true, what's the safest thing to do. And so that's why I always go back to my doctor, you know.
And to throw a wrench into the works, we're anticipating the approval of vaccines for children, five and above. We'll talk about that when we come back. We'll also talk about the lieutenant governor's remarks of late and school bus driver pay raises and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eric Spanberger is with us from the Charlotte Business Journal. Claire Donnelly from WFAE News. Katie Peralta Soloff from Axios Charlotte. And Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News 1. The White House has told states to prepare for COVID vaccinations for young children. They are anticipating shots could be approved and available for children as young as 5. And the Biden administration has already put forth the money to buy 65 million pediatric doses of the Pfizer vaccine. When might this get FDA approval and start being administered? Claire, do we know?
Soon. The one thing I was going to say is I think, you know, this is huge. So if you're a parent with a kid under 12, you have felt left out of so much of all of the, you know, pushes for people to get vaccinated and kind of the return to normal that so many people have been talking about. This is a big chunk of the population that hasn't been able to get vaccinated and gets left out of the conversation. So it could make a really big difference in the numbers.
And yet children 12 and up have been able to get this shot for a few weeks now, I think, maybe a month or so. Just 55% of 12 to 15-year-olds have been partly vaccinated, along with 62% of 16 and 17-year-olds. 70% of adults over 40 have gotten the vaccine. So why are the kids lagging?
I don't know that we know for sure. That would be a good question for public health officials. I mean, I do know that there are often parents who choose not to get their children vaccinated because if you're 12 to 15, your parent can make that choice for you. So that could be playing into it, but I don't know that we know for sure.
So as the pandemic has worn on, some people are becoming increasingly pessimistic about a return to normal. Get the vaccine, and that will speed that up. Some people are waiting, though, for the all clear. It's all over. You can come out now. And that apparently is not going to happen. Dr. David Priest, once again from Novant, says that's not how it will happen. He says it's going to piddle out over time. That is his quote there. And he says, he adds that nothing replaces the vaccine. Get your shots, get your booster if you are eligible. Well, jobs are going unfilled, Katie, all over the place, and people are quitting their jobs because they want more money. And evidently, CMS has had trouble hiring bus drivers, but they've come up with what they hope will be a solution. What is it?
Essentially, they plan to hire fewer bus drivers, but pay them more in an effort to attract and retain workers. They're going to up pay to $17.75 an hour, and they will increase pay for experienced drivers to up by $2 to $3 an hour. This is not this, you know, quote unquote shortage is not unique to bus drivers. There's a lack of workers in all areas in education in Charlotte and beyond. Of course, we've heard about substitute teachers, janitors, you know, all types of staff at schools. So this is meant to bring folks back in. There's been interesting discourse. Whenever I use the word labor shortage, I'm quickly corrected on the internet. There's not a labor shortage. There's a shortage of fairly paid jobs. And then a lot goes into that too. You know, there's a lack of affordable childcare. There's a lack of benefits. There's a lack of, support in these jobs for folks who, quite frankly, want more than $20 an hour. Because if that's all you want, you can get a job at, you know, McDonald's. Oftentimes, McDonald's jobs will pay more. Amazon is going to pay more and offer benefits. So it's a very competitive time for employers, and they need to do everything that they can to retain workers if they're serious about addressing these problems, because workers are fed up and they're not willing to make less than they were. It's not, you know, people don't take full-time jobs out of the goodness of their hearts. Right. They need the money and they need the support.
And we are in the first significant inflationary period in many people's lifetimes or many people's memories right now. And more higher wages means the cost of goods and services must rise, which maybe will exacerbate inflation. One of the ways that CMS is trying to keep this at bay, these raises are going to cost the system, $5 million. And that is why they are consolidating bus routes and reducing the number of drivers so they can keep that money in line with what their budget is. North Carolina Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson has come under fire for comments he made in June that have just now come to light. He was speaking at Asbury Baptist Church in Seagrove about what he called indoctrination in classrooms, using what he describes as highly sexual material.
Those issues have no place in a school. There's no reason anybody anywhere in America should be telling any child about transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. And yes, I called it filth. And if you don't like it that I called it filth, come see me and I'll explain it to you.
That was back in June. What provoked, Jonathan, what provoked those comments?
It's a good question. I think what provoked it is what the lieutenant governor sees as problems with what's being taught, books that are being taught in North Carolina schools, and whether or not they show explicit images and promote homosexuality and free expression, that sort of thing. But when you look, Spectrum News, we spoke to him both before and after these comments broke news. And again, he doubled down on what he said, but you look at schools across the country or across the state, we checked with Department of Public Instruction, and we can't really find very many schools, if any at all, where these books are actually being taught, where teachers are using these books. So to your question of what motivated this, one can only assume it may have to do, as we've seen, Mecklenburg County, the city of Charlotte, and now Wake County and the city of Raleigh, as well as others, but here recently it's been those big two that have passed non-discrimination ordinances. protecting, you know, extending protections to the LGBTQ community. So one can only assume, I don't know that there's been a specific answer on what motivated this, but it's certainly targeted at what the lieutenant governor sees as problem publication curriculum in North Carolina schools.
And as you said, when he was challenged on this, he doubled down. He called the transgender movement, quote, the spirit of the Antichrist and demonic. And he made similar remarks last month at the North Carolina Values Coalition 10th anniversary celebration. He claimed that he was not, however, referring to transgender or gay individuals as filth.
We're not calling any person filth. We're not calling anyone anything less than human. We're talking about materials, inappropriate materials, that are being presented to our children. And we're talking about those politicians who have demonized me because I'm trying to get this out of our classrooms.
But as you say, there's very little evidence that this is in the classroom. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we checked with Department of Public Instruction, and there's, you know, unless it's not widely known, but it doesn't appear that there are many, if any, at all, that have these books. And these publications as part of their curriculum.
So can we chalk some of this at least up to Republican politics? Because this seems to be out of the playbook of many Republicans, conservative Republicans here and around the country. A number of Democrats have called for his resignation, and Democratic Governor Roy Cooper condemned Robinson's remarks.
He does not speak for North Carolina. We are a welcoming and inclusive state. And we want the entire nation and the world to know that.
The governor added that he thought it would be appropriate for Robinson to resign. Any chance that will happen?
Certainly doesn't seem like it. I mean, to your point, Mike, I think what you were hinting at is within his own party, the lieutenant governor has not been censured in any way. So it seems highly unlikely that anything like that would happen.
I was going to add the Republican reaction to this has been interesting, or lack thereof. Ted Budd and Pat McCrory both have been silent after this. And Mark Walker, Senate candidate Mark Walker, appeared to defend Robinson's comments on Twitter. So it's a very...
And also, House Speaker Tim Moore put out a statement where he somewhat defended Mark Robinson and agreed that there are some books and publications and curriculum in North Carolina schools that's inappropriate. He believes doesn't have a place, but he also, you know, said that he's for respecting all communities across the state. So somewhat defended what the lieutenant governor said, but didn't go as far as to use some of that language that the lieutenant governor used.
Well, despite all this going on in Raleigh, the governor had time to sign an energy bill described as a major reform designed to promote cleaner energy and change the way electric utilities are regulated. Some are doubtful about this, and consumer groups say it doesn't go far enough. It could lead to big price increases, too. What does the bill actually do?
Well, I think a lot of people are cheering the miracle of bipartisan legislation in the state of North Carolina. That in itself is notable. It does take some strong actions. 70% carbon reduction by 2030, and then carbon neutral by 2050. The State Utilities Commission will be the ones to sort this out and figure it out. But some of those concerns you're referring to, Mike, are about Duke Energy essentially would maintain a monopoly in the state in terms of providing energy, and advocates for competition say, you know, this is counterintuitive if you want rates to go down. And that in turn leads to the concerns you mentioned about lower income households in particular being hit hard by future rate increases.
It also sets goals for the state to reduce carbon emissions from power plants by 70% by 2005 levels by 2030, yep, and be at net zero carbon by 2050. That means changes at power plants, no coal. Is what that means. And this bill allows ratepayers to foot some of the cost. Do we have any idea how much electric bills might go up over the next several years to help this?
We don't know how much. We know they will go up. And we also know that a lot of people are thinking that there will be additional legislation needed to sort some of these things out. But the first step is for the Utilities Commission to begin hatching a plan and then see how it is received and whether lawmakers want to do more.
Despite a shocking amount of gun violence in Charlotte, CMPD reports that overall crime is down by 4% this year as compared with the first 9 months of last year. Violent crime fell 3%, although sexual assaults are up 17% in the third quarter. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings says that drop in crime may have to do with life returning to normal.
What I can tell you is that as things start to open up, as kids are back in school, as people are going back to work, I think that creates less opportunities of some of these criminal activities that we've seen.
This decline in overall crime has left police, quote, cautiously optimistic, but guns are still a big problem.
We do have an issue with guns being out in the street. We do have an issue with people resorting to guns to deal with violent and criminal acts. And that's one of the things that we have always been made at the forefront of what we do in our initiatives to fight violent crime within CMPD.
And Chief Jennings added that one concerning trend is the increase in guns stolen from vehicles, about 700 so far this year. That's a 35% increase over last year. And he says CMPD has seized nearly 2,300 illegal guns so far this year. Well, Charlotte is becoming a tech city, as you know, Katie. And this week, one of our bigger firms, a homegrown one, AvidXchange, went public. What does that mean for Charlotte?
Well, tech industry leaders kind of point to this as the latest sign of us becoming this sort of hotspot for tech growth. And of course, besides the fact that this IPO created an extraordinary amount of wealth for both early investors and company executives and leaders, it also kind of bolsters Charlotte's reputation a little bit as a tech town. And I think that we've seen that growth really accelerate in recent years with companies adding tech talent here like Lowe's, Arrival, Centene. The list is really quite long. And I think that if you look back to the days of Amazon when we were snubbed for the HQ2 shortlist, we seem to have sort of been overcompensating for that chip on our shoulder. So things
despite
have certainly
the great video.
Changed.
Yeah. And Mike Prager, who's the company CEO, started this company in a coffee shop. And his 14 million shares on the day they went public became worth $350 million. So that was a good $5 cup of coffee. That was a good investment. very quickly, exactly. Fat Burrito is coming back. Is that right, Katie? Where?
Okay, so I thought we should talk about this, not just because it's just another restaurant opening, but it sort of signals, you know, the emergence of restaurants again after the closures of the pandemic. And it's coming into the Loso neighborhood, which I know people hate the name of. But this guy bought the rights to, or bought Fat Burrito's brand, I guess last year, and wanted to resurrect it because Fat Burrito was seen as this sort of iconic spot in a place where, you know, where South End was once funky and cool, and now it's very corporate. So
this won't be won't be funky. This iteration won't be funky. You have very quickly. We have 30 seconds. Eric, you have a story about anticipation, increasing interest in Charlotte Hornets ticket sales. And I'm just curious as to why, because in their they've only won one preseason game, and in their last one against Dallas, they lost it 127-59. What's the excitement over, LaMelo?
I think they're trying to kill my story. That's what they're trying to do. But yes, it's LaMelo, and they think they're going to be better. And that one didn't count. So hopefully when they start the season next week, they'll be better. October 20th, home opener.
Okay.
I thought you were out of time, so I was going quickly.
I know. Charlotte ranks fifth in the NBA now for new season tickets, and you report overall sales are the best they've been in 4 years. It's all on your shoulders, LaMelo. Carry that ball, baby. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Katie Peralta-Soloff, reporter for Axios. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, and Claire Donnelly from WFAE News. Thank you all. Happy Friday. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.